Okay, we are recording. And one last thing. You have an option. The option is to write on one, two, or three of the topics. And whichever topic you write on, whichever combination of topics you write on, you must produce a total of around between 10 and 15 pages. Okay, so this leaves you the option of doing five-page essays, doing a 10 to 15-page paper, doing two seven-and-a-half-page, you understand? So I've given this to... that's at the outset, right? I've given this as an option because some people freak out about doing what they consider to be long philosophy papers, although it's always good to do them, and I encourage you to do that. But there's an option here, so you can mix and match if you wish.
When's it
going to
be due?
Oh, yeah. Where are you? Who asked that question? Where the hell have you been?
Not here,
yeah. Ask somebody else then. Come, because it is important to attend, and I am going to calculate attendance into the final grade, so you don't want to get too lax about that.
I just wasn't here on Monday. I wasn't
Pardon me?
I just wasn't here on Monday.
That's okay. You're standing in for all the other students in this class's on any particular occasion. You're just—I mean, I'm looking at you and I'm seeing all of the malcreants out there. Okay, let's take a look at real quick. I'm going to back up and I want to look at the third definitive article for Perpetual Peace. We're going to begin by discussing immigration a little bit and about the notion of cosmopolitan citizenship as it emerges from Kant's document in the third definitive article, and then as it is discussed by Habermas and then by Agamben. And this will lead us into the last section of the course, which is the section on surveillance, because Agamben writes in both areas, both the area of immigration, refugeeism, and the area of the development of domestic techniques for control of the population. Agamben is a contemporary Italian philosopher who has specialized in drawing the philosophical consequences of the experience of genocide in the 20th century and now in the 21st century. So we'll be taking a look at his work. The third definitive article for Perpetual Peace, Kant says, he gives it the title, "The law of world citizenship shall be limited to conditions of universal hospitality." Now you have to remember, go back to the Stoics here. One of the major advances that the Stoics made in moral philosophy was switching the framework of moral thought from the small-scale, self-contained community, self-governing community, to the human species as a whole. Now, it's a very interesting fact that Socrates, who is of course one of the great founders of the Western moral philosophical tradition, lived at a period of time in which Athens and Sparta were at war. And one of the most interesting events that occurred in this war is there was an island off the coast of Greece called Miletos. Miletos was a self-governing city-state, an island city-state. And Sparta and Athens were at war with one another. The Athenians, and Socrates was an adult at the time and a philosopher at the time, the Athenians sent a delegation to the Miletians, Miletus is the island's name, and they demanded that the Miletians pledge their loyalty to Athens. And this essentially would have made Miletus a subordinate power and a military alliance ruled by Athens. What was behind the attempt to do this was the worry that if Miletus tried to maintain its neutrality, it would eventually be swallowed up by Sparta and add to the Spartan power. So the Athenians sent their ambassadors to Miletus, and they proposed this, and the proposal was not a proposal, it was an ultimatum. Either you join us or dire consequences will follow. And the Miletans met in council, and they decided to maintain neutrality. And they said, Athens has no right to demand that we incorporate ourselves as a subordinate element into their alliance. We are a self-ruling city-state. What gives Athens the right to do this? And the Athenians replied, this is all recorded, by the way, not Herodotus, the other Greek historian, Thucydides' history, it's recorded that the Athenians said, what gives us the right is our power. It is the right of the strong to demand that the weak submit. Now, what's interesting is that Socrates, of course, and all of the moral philosophers of Greece rejected this as a conception of right. When it comes to the city-state itself, there's an important passage, for example, in the Republic, where Socrates argues against Thrasymachus, who argues that might is right. And yet this is the argument that the Athenians are giving to the Miletans. Well, the Miletans decided to reject the argument, and the result is that Athens laid siege to its naval fleet to Miletus, invaded, executed every Miletan male, and brought the women and children into slavery. Now, the reason why I'm pointing this out is that Socrates says not a word about this. And had he spoken up about it, it would clearly have been recorded in Plato's writings or in the writings of Xenophon or other people who chronicled Socrates' days. Why didn't he say anything about it? Well, he didn't say anything about it because the moral frame of reference for Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle is the polis. It is the self-governing city-state. We have moral obligations to our fellow citizens, to the people with whom we create a common life in the context of the city-state. Beyond the boundaries of the polis, force rules. Now, what happens in the transition to Stoicism, of course, is that the polis disintegrates. It disintegrates because it's first of all conquered by Alexander the Great and then by the Romans. And we get, instead of the polis, the multinational empire. But in the multinational empire, we have Athens, we have Sparta, we've got Miletus, we have city-states from all over the Greek world, we have political units from the Middle East and from Northern Europe and so forth, all incorporated into one legal framework and political framework. And it's on the basis of this that the Stoics developed their conception of the cosmopolis. In other words, the moral community is no longer the limited group of one's fellow citizens, at least when citizenship is defined the way it was in Athens as what connects us within a small-scale political unit. It is now defined as a relationship that exists between all members of the human community. That's cosmopolitanism. And what characterizes Kant's work is that Kant very self-consciously revives the Stoic cosmopolitan framework in the context of the 18th century. He is an explicit cosmopolitan, and he is arguing for cosmopolitanism. Well, one dimension of that argument is the idea that relations between nation states have to be pacified through the development of a free federation of states devoted to the maintenance of peace under the rule of law. This is a cosmopolitan conception. Law now pertains not just to the people within a national community, but it pertains to relations between national communities themselves. And the purpose of it is to pacify, in other words, to put an end to the violence of war, that is, in Kant's view, the most important moral problem of his period. There's another question, though, and the question is this. What does it mean to say that each individual is a member of a common moral community? What does it mean practically? What does it mean politically, and what does it mean legally? Well, Kant's legal framework, this framework of international law, regulates the relations between nation states. What it says is, to achieve perpetual peace, nation states have got to be willing to submit their disputes to adjudication before a tribunal, before a legal, international legal tribunal. And the international law that results from the relation of nation states is meant to pacify relations between national political entities. But what is the relationship between you as an individual, you as an American citizen, and the global political body? What is the relationship between you and international law? Now remember, Kant rejects the idea of a global government. If there were one government, then your relationship would be quite clear. You would be citizens of that global government. And to whatever extent you possess the rights of citizenship, they would be enforceable rights with respect to a global political entity, in the same way that your constitutional rights are enforceable with respect to the United States as a national political entity. Kant excludes that possibility by excluding the idea of a global state. So he said, and so now the question is, what is the content of citizenship in a cosmopolis, as Kant has reformulated it in his own terms? And he says, and this is the significance of the title of the third definitive article, the law of world citizenship shall be limited to conditions of universal hospitality. Now hospitality, the word hospitality is significant here. Now hospitality is generally what families extend to friends who are visiting, or to relatives that they wish were not visiting but in fact are. Right? Now hospitality is a welcoming into one's own home of someone who is not normally a member of the home. Well, the home here is the nation state, because the nation state remains the dominant political unit in Kant's framework. What makes you a citizen of the world is that you enjoy the right of hospitality. And the right of hospitality means the right to visit other nation states. Now, of course, this bears on the whole question of immigration. And we, as I've said, I think in the past, we face in the 20th century and in the 21st century is an immigration crisis. And the immigration crisis consists in the fact that large numbers of the world's population now live outside of their countries of citizenship. Now, whether they do it with the idea of naturalizing, of becoming citizens of the countries that they reside in, or not, whether they possess, as the French say, papers or not, whether they're sans papier or not, whether they're without papers or not.
Maybe they're seeking better life and better resources.
Oh, clearly. There are all sorts of reasons for, you know, the large immigration issue. I mean, dire poverty in the countries of origin. War, which has sent tons of people across national borders as refugees, and so forth. But these are the problems of the 20th and 21st centuries. They weren't Kant's problems. In Kant's day, if there was an immigration problem, the problem was getting people to become immigrants, in particular with respect to the United States, which was engaged in westward expansion at the time. It wasn't how to keep people out. But still, Kant recognizes that nations are sovereign, nation states are sovereign, and what that means is nation states have the right to regulate the flow of people across their national borders. But they do not have the right to prevent a flow. To say that we live in a cosmopolitan society means that each nation state must be willing to accept foreign visitors. But all this means is that no nation state has the right to close its borders. It doesn't mean that nation states don't have the right to regulate the flow. And in particular, there's no obligation that Kant sees to grant citizenship to a foreign visitor, except insofar as a nation state wants to create laws to do that. The right of hospitality is the right of people to travel to other countries, you know, given limits. I mean, obviously, if everybody wants to go to one country at one time, the nation can't handle that kind of influx, right? Given limits, it's the right of people to travel to other countries and to enjoy the protections of civil liberties, you know, of essentially the rights of citizenship while they are there, but without the right to vote, without the right to actually participate in decision making in that nation. There's no, the visits can be limited. You know, there can be visas that regulate the amount of time that people are allowed to stay and so forth. But look at the logic behind this, right? The logic is that the nation state remains sovereign in Kant's view, with one exception, and that is the demand that nation states submit their disputes with one another to legal adjudication. Sovereignty means being able to regulate one's national borders. But since the framework that allows perpetual peace to occur is cosmopolitan in character, any nation state that prohibits visits essentially subtracts itself from the world population. In other words, it secedes from the cosmopolitan community. And so for cosmopolitanism to have meaning, people have got to have the right to be in communication with the residents of other nations. Undoubtedly, if Kant had lived to see the internet, he would have had things to say about the maintenance of lines of communication between peoples. And that might bear, for example, on the policies that China now is pursuing in terms of the restriction of internet communication through its borders and so forth. Without the ability to communicate with one another, there is no real cosmopolitan community. And so the right to hospitality for Kant is really the right to communicate in the process of building up a human collective that's real. In other words, connecting with people outside of our own national community. Now, as I said, time has passed, and we are now living in a very different era. We're living in an era in which a number of things have happened. First of all, we've experienced all the problems that Hobsbawm documents and Barbarism, a User's Guide. We've been through the experience of genocide a number of times in the past century and a half, you know, including the genocide of the Armenians, the genocide of the Jews, the genocide in Cambodia, the genocide, some would say, even in Vietnam as a result of the Vietnam War and so forth. We've been through mass deaths on a gigantic scale. And so, I'm going to lecture. And so, that has created a whole new set of problems, which, remember, Habermas addresses by reformulating Kant's program. And remember how he does this. He reformulates it by saying that we've got essentially what Kant was advocating for. We have the UN. The UN is a federation of nations. It doesn't rob, it doesn't destroy national sovereignty, but it encodes in the form of the treaties that each member nation signs when it joins the UN. And by the way, when the US government signs a treaty, the Supreme Court has ruled any number of times that that treaty has the force of law. In other words, provided it's constitutional, it has the same weight that any other law that Congress passes has. So by signing the treaty that makes the US a member of the United Nations, the US agrees to incorporate certain aspects of that into American law, including, by the way, the Charter of Human Rights, which is very significant in Habermas's reformulation of Kant's program. Okay, we need to expand that, though, Habermas says, beyond Kant's conception of relations between nations that adjudicate disputes before they break out. That's still a very important goal, and he thinks the Security Council has to be reformed. Other things have to happen. For example, there have to be regional powers that can counterbalance the United States, you know, not antagonistically, but that can begin to undercut the partiality in the application of intervention. You know, why is it that the UN only intervenes against enemies of the U.S.? You know, why does it ever intervene against allies of the U.S.? Well, clearly it's because the U.S. has inordinate power globally. In order to make a federation devoted to peace real, according to Habermas, we would need to have regions counterbalancing U.S. power, including the European Union, including maybe a Latin American region, a South Asian, Southeast Asian region, and so forth, so that the playing field becomes level. And then when the world body makes decisions, it makes decisions that are more even-handed than it has in the past. That's one of his conceptions of how the UN has to be reformed. Security Council has to be reformed so that it's no longer a relic of the Second World War, you know, 65 years later, and so forth. But his major innovation is the following, and it's in line really with contemporary UN practice. He says, given the fact that there have been genocides of enormous proportions over the past couple of centuries, the world body must have a mechanism for intervening when people's rights are violated by their own governments. Now, this is not the classical situation of war. You know, war is generally conceived of as a conflict between nation states in which each nation state is pursuing its own quote-unquote national interest. But what Habermas accepts as human rights interventions is something different. A human rights intervention is the application of military force to protect the rights of global citizens against the infringements of their own national regime, or perhaps against human rights debacles that occur when there is no government, when the government disintegrates and warfare breaks out between the Hutus and the Tutsis and so forth and so on in various scenarios. This has also happened in recent years. There has to be the right to intervene by the world body in order to prevent massive human rights abuses. But you see, that changes the nature of global citizenship. Global citizenship is now no longer limited to the right to hospitality. It's no longer limited to Kant's right to communicate across national borders, although that remains absolutely vital. Without communication, for example, you don't even know if there's a human rights violation going on in a nation state. But now, world citizenship becomes a relationship that each individual human being enjoys with respect to the UN Charter of Human Rights, which is now enforceable by the world body. So now, you are not just a citizen of the United States, and therefore you possess rights that are enforceable under the Constitution. You are now a global citizen who possesses rights that are enforceable under the UN Charter. And what makes those rights enforceable is what makes your rights enforceable as a U.S. citizen, namely that there is, and I'll use the word that Habermas would prefer that we use, there is a police force that is capable of intervening when your rights are violated. So just as a national government maintains a police force that can enforce law, and that can enforce law to protect the rights that are spelled out in the Constitution, so would an international body such as the UN possess a police force that can intervene to protect your rights under the UN Charter. But Habermas also accepts Kant's restrictions, his skepticism about a global government, and he says the only way that such a police force can be convened, it can be created, is by having member nation states supply the troops. And this is essentially the principle that's guided human rights interventions in recent years. You know, there's a human rights crisis in Kosovo. So what happens is member nations supply troops there. It was under the UN umbrella, it was under the NATO umbrella, but the UN signed off on it. It's a little bit secondhand, but still, essentially it had the UN imprimatur, the stamp of approval on it, and contributing nations, member nations, send members of their armed forces to intervene in Kosovo. And that's the model. But you see, that radically shifts the nature of cosmopolitan citizenship. Now cosmopolitan citizenship is a matter of enforceable cosmopolitan law, not international law. International law regulates the relations between nation states. The UN Charter of Rights is not international law. It doesn't have to deal with relations between nation states. It has to do with your relationship with whatever interferes with the expression and enjoyment of your rights. So now we have not just international law, but we have cosmopolitan law, a new branch of law that opens up. Now we're at the very beginnings of this. Now there's no doubt about it, right? Human rights interventions have just become something significant. Really, when did they first occur? Under Clinton? Wasn't that it? Maybe a little bit before? We're not talking about anything that's very long-lived. So we're talking about an emerging structure here that Habermas thinks that with reform, and in particular with some counterbalances to unilateral U.S. power, would actually provide the framework for a functioning cosmopolitan society. And this would be the coming to fruition of the Stoic moral framework. Habermas doesn't say this, I'm saying this. Yeah.
Well, what about conflicts in international waters where no one owns the borders?
That's a problem, but that's always fallen under the UN. And the UN is actually the International Court of Justice is responsible for adjudicating that. That's a UN body. And actually, that's the one thing the UN has done rather well historically, is deal with questions of national borders. Sometimes it's failed, but in general, not so that war breaks out as a result of it. It's been less good at preventing wars from happening, right? But you might want to say that's one reason for that is that the decision-making gets filtered in a way that makes it sort of unacceptable globally. It's clear to most members of the General Assembly that when the U.S. puts a stamp of approval on a war, it's because the U.S. supports it, right? Or the U.S. wants it. And if it's unable to put a stamp of approval, then it's because the U.S. opposes it. And that undermines the moral authority, of the U.N. as a body for regulating relations between nations. So that's one reason why Habermas proposes. And you see, he says, look, this is happening anyway. The EU is pulled together across national boundaries, right? That's the biggest, and it's not there yet. It's not capable of acting as a counterweight yet, but it's getting there. Right now, I don't know if you noticed, the Obama administration, through Hillary Clinton, is trying to convince NATO to maintain nuclear weapons in Europe. Well, NATO wants to get rid of them. This is the first time there's been a real dispute between NATO and the United States. NATO was a creation of the U.S., Cold War creation against the Soviet Union. But now NATO is saying, we're Europeans, we're not Americans. And we have different interests than the United States does, and our interests lie in nuclear disarmament. And so Hillary Clinton is arguing herself blue in the face to keep the nuclear weapons in Europe because that's a part of American military strategy. But I don't know how that's going to end up. It could, the EU could very well capitulate to the US, but the point is, it's moving in the direction of independence. China, what's the significance of China? I personally never thought that China was going to be the new global hegemon. I think it's more likely that we're at the end of global hegemony, that no nation state will be able to fulfill the role that the U.S. played after the Second World War. But what China could very easily do is become the center of a South Asian region that would have significant power, economic power, military power, diplomatic power, and so on. In Latin America, for the first time, we're seeing the attempts to develop a regional power, first economically, but also eventually, politically and militarily, that's capable of counterbalancing the U.S. It isn't just an extension of the U.S. In the form of Mercosur, there's another regional organization that's developing at the initiative of Venezuela, and so forth. And so Habermas sees all of this as positive. And have to remember, Habermas is very pro-American. Habermas was argued against the rest of the German left's sort of alliance or toleration anyway for the East Bloc regimes. And you thought in the post-war period it was very important for West Germany to function under the U.S. umbrella, and he still, you know, feels that the U.S. political system as the heir to the American Revolution is very significant and so forth. But I think what happened, was George Bush, the second, you know, really changed the tenor of his work, and he's begun to stress much more this notion of counterbalancing globally. Well, okay. Let me shift to Agamben, because I do want to get to Agamben before we're done today. Agamben's an Italian philosopher, as I said, who has based a lot of his work on an analysis, a philosophical, historical, and legal analysis of the regimes that engaged in human rights violations, in particular Germany during the Nazi period. And he looks at, for example, German law very carefully during the period of the Holocaust. And he looks at the organization of concentration camps, not just as historical events, but as administrative events. And how were they actually, how was it actually carried out? You know, what significance did it have on the impact of the legal system of the nations involved and so forth? And in the article that we read by him, he actually builds upon the work of Hannah Arendt, who's a very interesting philosopher. It's one of the, I think, the effects of patriarchal civilization that women have not generally excelled at philosophy historically. Well, largely because they've been kept out of studying it. You know, when Epicurus let women in to his community, he was the butt of jokes. You know, oh, you're all having sex with one another, right? How can a woman be a member of a philosophical community? You know, the garden is a place of orgies and that kind of thing. Well, for a long period of time, of course, women were marginalized when it came to the practice of philosophy. It's only in the 20th century that women have begun to emerge, and two of them in particular have achieved really significant status. One is Simone de Beauvoir, who's French, and who wrote a whole series of works during the 50s and 60s and 70s, and the other is Hannah Arendt. Hannah Arendt is a German Jew who was a refugee from the Nazi regime. And she studied in Germany, where she became well known as a, you know, as a up and coming philosopher. But then the Nazis came to power, and she moved to New York City as an immigrant. And she began teaching at the New School for Social Research in New York, which is where she taught until she died. She wrote a series of books that had a tremendous impact. She's a brilliant political philosopher, and I highly recommend her works. But she wrote an article called We Refugees, and it was a philosophical reflection on the significance of refugeeism. Remember, she was a refugee during this period of time. Refugees were created on a mass scale really around the time of the First World War. And you can understand why that happened, because with the advent of what Hobsbawm calls total war, domestic populations were uprooted as military action was now carried out in cities, in places where industries were producing munitions and so forth. And so civilians lost their homes as homes were bombed, as warfare was extended to their regions. And they had to uproot themselves. They had to become refugees. Well, often the uprooting meant crossing national borders and seeking refuge in neutral countries, or in countries that were not immediately the scene of military conflict at the time and so forth. So we had, during this period, a little bit before, but mostly the First World War, we had the emergence of the refugee camp. And the refugee camp is an encampment that's created by a nation state to house the refugees that cross over into its borders. Well, what Hannah Arendt pointed out, and this is something that Agamben really stresses in his article, is that the refugee camp is the origins of the death camp. In other words, if you look at the death camps of the Nazi regime, what you see is that they are, in a sense, the logical outcome of the refugee camps of the World War I period. And what does she mean by this? She refers back to the doctrine of human rights. Now, human rights are recognized in the, not by name, but in reality, by the American Bill of Rights, right? All men are created equal, right? Not just Americans, all men are created equal. They're endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. All human beings have inalienable rights. That's the doctrine of human rights. And then in the French Revolution, an important document was called The Rights of Man and the Citizen. Now there, the French document makes a distinction between citizenship rights and human rights. And it's an important distinction because citizenship rights are the rights that are guaranteed you by your national government. Your human rights are the rights that you possess as members of the human species. And the theory is that when your citizenship rights do not apply, your human rights kick in. So even when you are outside of your country of citizenship, you enjoy the protection of human rights. And what Hannah Arendt points out is that proved to be an empty conception. And what proved it to be an empty conception was the development of refugee camps. Because in the refugee camps, the refugees are stripped of their citizenship rights. And they also cease to enjoy any enforceable human rights at all. And if you look at refugee camps, what you see is that the only thing that protects people in the camps is the willingness of their host governments not to do them in. But it's very easy for host governments to violate what is recognized as the human rights of refugees. They have no presence in national law. They have no presence under the documents that spell out the rights of people within the nation state. So the first, and this is interesting because she looks at what happened in, and so does Agamben. And here, the two of them really are writing as one, although Agamben comes later than she does. What happened when the Jews were subjected to the final solution is it's very fascinating. The Nazis did not simply round them up and begin executing them. The first thing they did was submit them to legal proceedings. And the legal proceedings stripped them of German citizenship. Think of that, right? The legal proceedings stripped them of German citizenship because you could not herd German citizens onto troop trains and move them across, you know, national borders and put them in concentration camps in Poland and, you know, force them to do heavy labor until they dropped or until you decided to shovel them into the gas chambers of the incineration bins. You know, that was not legal. That was not legal. If you were a German citizen, you possessed citizenship rights. So the first step in annihilating the Jews was to strip them legally of their rights of citizenship. In other words, to make them refugees. The first step in the final solution was to change the status of German Jewry from citizen to refugee. Once Jews became internal refugees within Germany, then they could be subject to the administrative mechanisms of the final solution, you know, including being identified, being property taken away, being placed on trains, being transported to camps, and so on and so forth. Now, the ultimate logic of the refugee camp, Arendt says, is the death camp.
Well, why do they try to justify it? Why not just say we don't want them to be citizens because they go against our national interests?
But that's exactly what they did. They had to strip them of citizenship rights. And they had to do it through a legal procedure.
But why do they have to claims and justify and strip them of the rights and not just do it as German citizens if they don't agree?
Because Germany was a nation state. Mm-hmm. And a nation state is a sovereign political power that has the responsibility of creating laws and under which its citizens live. And even the Nazis, even under a Nazi regime, Germany was such a nation state. Germany went through the same procedures that any nation state would go through in stripping somebody of citizenship. See, I mean, I think the point of this is that Nazism was not just this irrational aberration that just all of a sudden came up from nowhere.
Very legally structured.
Pardon?
It was very legally structured.
Exactly. Exactly. It was, in essence, a pathology that is inherent in the nation state form, or at least a potentiality that's inherent in the nation state form. Once you no longer enjoy citizenship rights, the notion that you have human rights under a nation state regime comes to, in essence, nothing.
What happened to the human rights? Did they ignore?
Who was going to enforce them? You see, obviously, Agamben and Hannah Arendt are arguing about the world as it exists before it's reformed in accordance with Habermas's rules, right? See, if you had an international federation that actually intervened to enforce human rights, then human rights would be enforceable, but they would not be enforced any longer by nation states. It would be enforced by the world body. See, in essence, nation states are not set up to enforce human rights. And human rights are weakly protected under nation states. Well, you see, if this is true, then nation states are not going to be able to solve a range of problems that exist on the international scale, including the problem of immigration, including the problem of large numbers of, for example, the French population now being Arabs and Turks and North Africans sans papier, without papers. Well, look, I mean, there's no mystery why that is the central issue that the German right wing organizes around. You know, that the National Front, which is essentially a fascist group that sometimes comes damn close to winning national power in France. Le Pen was made it to the national elections last time around, or two times. But essentially, the sans papier population has become the potential Holocaust population of France. Of course, the French also, you know, refurbished their anti-Semitism too, the National Front. But basically, the National Front has been focused on the sans papier. Yeah. Well, these problems cannot be solved according to Agamben, and he's a little bit more strict about this than Arendt was, on the level of the nation state. So how do they get resolved? He does not himself propose, I don't know whether he's ever addressed the issue, he doesn't propose the solutions that Habermas proposes of a global body that can enforce human rights. What he proposes is the development of new political entities that are not nation states and also not world federations that are capable of addressing such problems. And here, he might have something to say. His example is Jerusalem. And his example is Jerusalem as it has been treated in some proposals, peace proposals for the Middle East. Some people have proposed, you know, Jerusalem is a major object of contention. And it's actually now a source of tension between the Obama administration and the Israeli government. And the reason why is that the current Israeli government is allowing settlers to settle in properties that had been owned very recently by Palestinians, and actually Palestinians are being evicted and Jewish settlers are taking their place, and this has upset the balance. You know, traditionally the U.S. has waffled on this question. The question is, what country is Jerusalem a capital of? Is it a capital? Is it the capital of Israel, or is it the capital of Palestine? Well, there are claims on both sides, and in particular, there are religious claims on both sides, because Jerusalem is a holy city. It's a holy city for Muslims, it's a holy city for Jews, it's a holy city for Christians. And so there have been huge, you know, Israel claims it as its capital, but the attempt to make it into a capital is politically impossible without, you know, throwing everything into turmoil, and so you get these sort of little small attempts to move some of the Palestinians out and put some of the Israeli Jewish population in, but that creates huge problems too, right? What do you do about Jerusalem? And so under some peace proposals, the idea is that Jerusalem should be, and there are two ways to look at this, either the capital of two countries or the capital of no countries. But you see, whether it's the, let's say it's a double capital, let's say it's the capital of Israel and the capital of Palestine, that breaks the limits of the nation state. Jerusalem as a city is no longer subject to the exclusive national sovereignty of one nation state. And of course, if it's the capital of no nations, then that breaks the limits of national sovereignty as well. The general idea is that if Jerusalem became a double capital or a stateless city or whatnot, what would happen is it would no longer be a bone of contention about who owns it. And it would remove one of the major sources of tension. But the question now is, what's the relationship between the members of Jerusalem and the city of Jerusalem? And what Agamben says is, under such a situation, under such a condition, all members of Jerusalem would be refugees. But they would be refugees with rights. And I think this is probably, now whether this makes sense or not, I think his point is interesting. His point is this: any serious reconstruction of the political order that is capable of solving the problem of refugeeism and ultimately the problem of genocide will have to adopt the perspective not of the citizen of the nation state, but the perspective of the refugee. In other words, the refugee becomes the point of reference now for a new political order. No political order that is incapable of protecting the lives and rights of the refugee is viable any longer. Well, you know, I personally like the idea of an international city. I don't know whether it would work in the Middle East, but I'd love to see New York turned into one. I mean, New York is one anyway. Anybody who thinks that New York is a part of the United States is crazy. He's never lived in New York. I mean, New York is not even a part of the Eastern Seaboard. I had two groups of friends visit me from New York this weekend. Both groups live in Manhattan. I used to live in the city. And it's amazing. You know, when Manhattanites are out of town, it's like they can't wait to get back. It's like, you know, what is this? People speak English here in Boston? What kind of currency do you have here? You know, it's such a self-referential place. And this is one of the things that drives Red Sox fans nuts. Because in general, Boston loathes New Yorkers. And New Yorkers don't give a shit about Bostonians. They don't even think about them. Except when they're beaten by the Red Sox, right? And then the Bostonians take great pride in being noticed by New Yorkers. But what makes New York so self-referential is that when you pass through the streets of New York, you pass, if you were there for a week, you will pass. I will challenge you to point to a nationality whom you have not passed in the streets. Everybody is there. I mean, literally, everybody is there. You know, and sometimes in small communities, right? And I used to teach at the Brooklyn campus of Long Island University, and I used to walk from my apartment, which was a good mile and a half away, just to get some exercise. I swear to God, I mean, I passed the entire Caribbean. There's a huge Caribbean population, and you know, Jamaicans, Trinidadians, and you know, they all have their places, and they're all selling their wares on the streets of until you get to Flatbush Avenue, and then it's like a marketplace in the Caribbean. Haitians, you name it, right? But, Hasidic Jews, huge community, right? I grew up with Hasidic Jews in my hometown of New Jersey. They're amazing people. I mean, they're living a lifestyle that, I don't know how the hell they do it. It's like out of the 17th century.
Pardon? I don't know if amazing is the right word.
It's like out of the 17th century, right? They basically have not moved out of the 17th century, except that they run fantastic camera stores and computer shops. It's the weirdest thing, you know? But in any event, you know, why should New York be a part of the United States? It's basically an international city already. And so the idea is that there are ways to soften up the problems of national sovereignty that don't involve the creation of a global federation of states, that involve new political arrangements on a more local scale. Okay? Next time, we will do Foucault, and so we'll discuss Discipline and Punish. So please read that.
So, in all the loyalty to the country and